Thanks so much for joining us today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller for another edition of Garden Talk. Always a pleasure to have you along to ask your plant-related questions and to share your tips and ideas for great gardening indoors and out. We're happy to have Patty Nagai joining us today. She is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County, and she is joining us by phone. Hi, Patty. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, as I mentioned in the promo, it's a good time to be finishing up those last few things outdoors, hopefully just those last few things. I was out there yesterday. It was actually pretty balmy here in Madison, and I know other parts of the state are still enjoying some pretty mild temperatures, but it's also a good time to turn our attention to houseplants, and so that's going to be our focus today. But Patty, like so many of the UW Extension horticulture educators, really knows a lot about just about every kind of growing plant. So she can also help with some other issues if you have those questions. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Chris Molina is our on-air producer today. He will get your calls and emails through to us. So Patty, first off, what makes a plant a good candidate to be a houseplant? I was thinking about, you know, there are perennials in the garden, but those are not necessarily the ones that grow inside. So what makes a good indoor houseplant?
Well, it really depends on your indoor conditions. And, you know, I always recommend that people try to select plants that fit not only their interior, because a lot of times people are using plants for, you know, decoration, and that's fine. You know, we love having green things around us. We love having flowers around us. And there's a tremendous amount of research that shows that makes us feel better. It can reduce blood pressure. It can help people with dementia. It can help everyday people with their challenges and stresses. And it really is good for your interior environment to have plants in the house. But it's never fun to have dying plants in the house. You know?
That's kind of the opposite psychological effect.
Yes, it's really, really bad feng shui to have a plant that's declining and dropping leaves and being yellow and unhappy. So, you know, I really try to encourage people to investigate their interior surroundings really well. If they are planning on bringing plants in, that they really want to grow and thrive. Now, at the holiday season, when you're bringing plants in, a lot of times it is strictly for decoration, and that's a different picture altogether. But if you really want plants to grow and thrive in your house, you need to have a good understanding of the light levels. You need to know a little bit of care about how to water carefully and correctly. There's a little bit to know about containers, about insects. You know, it's not rocket science. It really isn't. But there are a lot of things that you need to have a better understanding of. You can't expect to bring a tropical plant into your home, you know, freshly brought up here from Florida, and just plop it down in a dark room and have it survive. Mm-hmm. And so with a little bit of understanding before you go shopping for a plant, you know, I think anybody can choose a really good interior plant or mini that will grow well in their homes and bring them a lot of joy for years and years and years.
Well, and as I think about it, Patty, one of the things that a houseplant needs to be able to tolerate, I guess, is one way of looking at it, is that we generally keep our interior climate pretty consistent throughout the year. And so there might be, you know, it might be a little cooler inside in the winter. It might be a little warmer in the summer, you know, depending on how much we're regulating our climate for ourselves. But any plants that need, you know, like to go through a dormancy period, it seems like they might not be the best candidates for being indoor plants.
Well, that's true. And so a lot of things that we grow outside are really better off outside. And we would prefer to keep them out there. And when it comes to houseplants, with most of them, because our interiors are pretty consistent throughout the year, the plants will be happier if you keep them inside year-round. Mm. Now, there are some exceptions to that, and I challenge myself every year with things that I will take outside and bring back in and things that probably aren't supposed to grow in Wisconsin at all. But you know, for the most part, an interior plant is an interior plant, and an exterior plant is an exterior plant. Mm-hmm. And there, occasionally we have crossover. You know, for example, I know a lot of vegetable growers who are just really passionate about growing edible food crops, and so they want to grow edible food crops indoors. And there are some things that can do that. And some things that we grow as annuals, like peppers and tomatoes, are actually perennials.
Hmm.
And you can grow them inside, and you can grow them over the winter with the proper care, enough light and things like that. Peppers are easier to do than tomatoes. And, of course, you can grow herbs inside, and those are exterior plants. So there are always exceptions. You know, there's no hard and fast rules about, you know, what will work and what won't.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times you just have to try things and try new alternatives for growing plants indoors and outdoors. So
for the person that doesn't think they're good with plants, or they might, you know, go for periods where they don't think about giving plants a lot of care or attention, what are some pretty low maintenance or dare we say it, hard to kill houseplants?
There are a lot of hard to kill houseplants. And, you know, even though I am a horticulturist and I have, you know, I claim to have been a horticulturist all of my life because I started gardening at a very young age with my grandfather. And so, you know, I've been in the plant world for a very long time. I kill plants all the time. I do. I admit it. And it's one of the first things I ask my classes when I'm teaching a course on houseplants. You know, go ahead, admit it. How many of you have killed a plant? And, you know, and I think it makes them feel better to go ahead and admit that and get it out of their system. And then I tell them, of course, I have killed plants also. It's not a, you know, it's not the end of the world. It's how we learn about what to do and what not to do and what really will work in our environments. But some really easy ones, and, you know, some of these may not surprise you. And for those who are, you know, really good gardeners, they won't be surprised by this at all. And then some of them may surprise you. So, for example, most of the things in the arum family, which is the philodendron family, philodendrons, pothos, and there's so many different sizes and shapes and colors, a lot of different species in that family, that actually do very well as houseplants. They do have a little bit of time to acclimate to your environment, but they can go a long time without water. There are many dracaenas that can also go for quite a long period of time with no water and a little bit of neglect. But, you know, with a lot of these plants, how much water they get really depends on some other factors. You know, you have to take into account pot size and how much light they're getting and how dry the area is and things like that.
And what's a dracaena? What does that look like?
A dracaena, one type that a lot of people are familiar with is the corn plant.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a red margin or dragon dracaena. There are a lot of different kinds. The easiest to grow, the one that is the most difficult to kill, is called a Janet Craig, and it is dark, dark green, but it looks, I can see why people call it a corn plant, because the foliage is like that. It looks grassy. It's a wide grass blade, and it comes from a central stem, and it's very, under good conditions, it's very full, and it will have leaves all up and down. Under bad conditions, it loses all of its lower leaves and then ends up with this little tuft up at the top.
That
which
doesn't,
is fine.
Doesn't sound like the most attractive addition. But.
Well, it's a functional plant.
There
I call those functional plants, because a lot of our tropical foliage plants that are truly hard to kill are the ones that you see in office buildings. You see them in doctor's offices, in the shopping malls, you know, in places where there may not be a lot of natural light and the light levels are a little bit lower, the care is a little bit less frequent,
mm-hmm.
and so you have areas where, you know, the plants aren't going to get quite as much care. And so those are I call those the functional plants. Now, the things that are prettier that are also very difficult to kill are things like some of the orchids, the moth orchids, very hardy. If you have a location that has some bright light, not direct sun, but bright light, and you have a little bit of humidity, because they do like, they like to be around other plants, or they like to be in a more humid environment. You know, the orchids are really pretty tough to kill, and they don't like to be watered so frequently.
Mm.
So if you're somebody who travels or just doesn't think about watering your plants very often, you know, if you go a couple of weeks without watering your orchids, they'll be just fine. In fact, they'll be happier for it.
I have to say, I've always been kind of intimidated by orchids, because they do look so exotic and pretty pretty delicate in as far as, you know, their plant structure. So now I'm intrigued that maybe even I could grow an orchid.
I think you could. And, you know, another one, if you've got a bright window, that's really pretty easy to grow are the hibiscus. And there are a lot of different types of tropical hibiscus. I have a couple of the standard red ones, but this year I bought one that's a double-flowering yellow hibiscus. And the flowers almost look like roses. They are just gorgeous. And it's in full bloom right now.
Wow.
In my kitchen window.
Well, so, and actually, Jan in Duluth has a question about a hibiscus, so let's go to Jan. Hi, Jan.
Perfect. Okay.
Hi. I've had this hibiscus for years, and it's kind of from my mother. And at first I thought the cats were chewing on it, and I found stickiness, like where the leaf attaches to the stem, and I've seen like a grain of sea salt on it, and, you know, like here and there. And I've been dealing with this for years. I've sprayed it on the deck with water real hard, and I've sprayed it with, bug killers, thinking maybe mites, but I can't seem to get rid of it, and it's driving me insane.
Yeah, you know, and there, this is one of the problems that we have with interior plants, is that when we do get insect infestations, they're often difficult to control. And in previous years, I have often recommended that people throw their plants out when they get certain types of insects because they're really difficult to control. But now there's some newer products on the market that make it a little bit easier. Have you ever seen a scale insect, and do you know what that looks like?
Are they like a little black dot?
Well, not always. There are a lot of different types of scale insects, and they can look really different. But typically the one that I see on hibiscus is kind of a tan to a darker brown color.
I haven't seen that. All
and
I've
they just
seen
look like little shells. They don't look like anything.
Yeah, I have seen them someplace else, but that's not what I've seen on my hibiscus.
Okay. And then the other type of scale insect that sometimes hibiscus gets is a mealybug, which is white.
Uh-huh.
And so that can be a problem on hibiscus as well.
Yeah, I shake it, and the only thing I've seen is like that little grain of sea salt, and I'll pick it off the leaf, and it'll be gooey, and it'll crumble in my fingers.
Is it sticky?
Yes.
That could be mealybug, because mealybug is kind of white, and it's small.
Okay.
And it's also a scale-type insect, but instead of developing that hard shell on the outside, a mealybug gets this gooey white stuff on the outside.
Okay, that would be it then.
Yeah. So with all of those scale-type insects, those are insects that suck the sap out of the plants, and they tend to stick their little proboscis in there, and then they stay there, so they don't move around a whole lot. But they give birth, and then their little babies, those little crawlers, will crawl around. And so there's kind of a multi-step approach to killing these insects. Because they are firmly lodged into the leaves or the stems or the petioles of the plant or down in the nooks and crannies of the nodes, they're very difficult to use. It's very difficult to get an insecticide on them that will kill them. But there are some systemic insecticides that can be used on interior plants, like hibiscus, and they contain the chemical imidacloprid, which is imidacloprid, and it's the same product that's found in a lot of exterior chemicals for like roses and emerald ash borer on ash trees and things like that. But you have to buy the formulation that's for an interior plant, and you can treat the soil with that, and it'll take up in the plant, and given enough time, it will affect the scale. But the second important step that you have to do is what you have been doing is washing off the plant on a regular basis. And so that helps to take care of the little crawlers. It helps to disrupt the insects. And so I found that by using those two different methods together, you can rid houseplants of those scale-type insects. But it's a challenge. And with really serious infestations, I sometimes do go back to the original recommendation of throwing the plant out and starting over. But the problem is that if you've got scale on one plant, often you'll have it on multiple plants. And so you need to really be careful and make sure you're not spreading it from plant to plant with your with your pruning tools or your watering can or your hands or, you know, by moving plants around so that they're right next to each other, because a lot of those scale insects will get on multiple species. And the telltale sign is what you initially said about the stickiness. A lot of times when you have scale on any plant, people won't notice the insect at all because it is so tiny, but they'll notice the stickiness. Mm. So the floor will be sticky, the other leaves will be sticky, carpeting, countertops, wherever the plant is will get really sticky and shiny.
Hmm. Wow. Well, thanks for that call, Jen. And it sounds like there is hope for your hibiscus. So good luck with that. So, Patty, it sounds like there are some insect issues or pest issues like the scale insects that a systemic might be good. Are there other types of pests that there are topical types of treatments that are better?
Well, topical treatments on an interior plant is always a challenge. And because, you know, they're in their house, and so how do you spray something in your house without making an even bigger mess than the insect was making? And so I have found a number of different organic products that are that contain plant oils. So some of them are, you know, some of them are older products, and then there are also the insecticidal soap products. And many of these newer products that contain the plant oils have insecticidal soap also. And so these are organic-based products. They're very safe to use in the house. They're, I believe all of the ones that I've used are even safe for any kind of edible crop. They're very, very safe. But it's messy to spray. And so during the active growing season, I may take plants outside to treat them. During the winter months, I will put them in a shower stall and spray them and let the spray dry completely before I move them back out to their normal growing place. So it's, you know, it's a challenge to figure out how to treat a plant inside, because, of course, you don't want to spray these chemicals all over your windows and your floor, right, and your carpet and furniture and all of that.
Now,
but there are a number of different products out there now for interior plants. And the key to any kind of insect control, whether you're exterior or interior, is to know the insect. You need to know the insect that you're trying to treat. So you need a positive ID. And that's where UW Extension can help out a lot, because we can do insect ID for you in all of our offices. Sometimes we can do it by a photograph. And most counties have master gardener volunteers or horticulturists or both who can help with insect ID. So you need to identify the insect first. You need to make sure that you're reading the label very carefully before you buy it, and it is truly labeled for an interior plant, and that you follow all the label instructions for application.
And actually, Patty, I was going to ask, but I think you just answered this, but just to be clear, because you do need to know exactly what you're treating for, these are all substances that you want to apply after you've noticed a problem and after you've identified what the problem is. You don't want to try to do it preventively or preemptively.
Right. And, you know, I rarely use insecticides on my interior plants. I have children. I have a dog. You know, I don't particularly want to use those systemic type chemicals in my house. I have used them under certain conditions, especially for the scale-type insects, which are really prevalent. I have citrus trees, and it's really hard to grow citrus without getting scale at some point. And so, you know, there are always instances where insecticides, you know, might be beneficial. But what I found with interior plants is that more often than not, if you take good care of your plants and keep them clean, and make sure you inspect any new plants before you bring them in your house, that you don't have too many insect problems. You know, people get insect problems when they bring in plants that are already infested with insects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so if you're taking your plants outside and bringing them back in, it's really important to clean them before you bring them in. And if you're bringing plants from a greenhouse, a nursery, you're getting plants from a friend or the grocery store or wherever, it's really important to inspect those plants really carefully before you add them to your collection.
It's Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Our guest today is Patty Nagai. She is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County, and she's happy to answer your questions when you call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Do you have a home or office full of plants? Which have been the most successful for you? We'd love to hear about your favorites right after this message. We are talking about houseplants, their care, good choices for your conditions, and what will brighten up your home or work environment. Patty Nagai is joining us. She's UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County. And Patty, we had an email from Sue. She says, I have had a potted bay leaf bush for 2 years and want to keep it healthy over the winter. Should I cut it back? And if so, how?
Oh, okay. So a bay leaf plant or a laurel plant, and she's had it inside, right?
It sounds like it, yes.
Okay. That these plants are really nice house plants, and besides that, they're useful plants because they, of course, are an herb that we use in cooking, so those are really nice. They can be pruned back in much the same fashion that you would a shrub or a tree. And so when you're pruning house plants, and house plants do need to be pruned, they will, especially if they're growing happily in your home. You know, you don't want them, you know, reaching the ceiling and trying to take over your house. But that particular one can be pruned back the same way you would prune back any other woody plant. And so you follow the recommendations of removing any branches that are broken or don't look quite right, branches that are crossing. When you prune back, you prune to an outward-facing bud. And so every time you cut back, whether you're shaping up or removing a broken or a diseased branch or something that doesn't look quite right, you want to make your cut just above a node, and you want the bud on that node to be facing outwards so that when the bud breaks, it grows out and then up as opposed to growing in towards the center of the plant. And so, and she said shrub form, right? And not tree form? Because it can be either one.
She just says a bay leaf bush.
Okay, so it's probably more of a shrub form. Because the bay leaf can also be pruned into a tree form with a single trunk and then more of a bushy top, like you see the tree form hibiscus and things like that. It can be pruned that way also. But if she's already got it as a kind of a multi-trunked or a multi-branched kind of a shrub, she probably wants to keep it in that shape. And so the goal is to shape it up, and you probably don't want to remove more than about a third of the total weight of the plant. And so when you're pruning back branches, try and visualize what a third of the shrub is going to look like, and you don't want to remove more than about a third. And then pruning, it's always good to keep in mind that pruning stimulates growth. So wherever you make those cuts, you're going to have new growth coming out. And even though it's winter, and even though our light levels are starting to decline, you know, if you're doing some significant pruning on a plant, you probably do need to start giving it a little bit of fertilizer. And so it may not be, if you haven't been fertilizing at all, you definitely would want to fertilize. If you've been fertilizing a lot over the summer, you would want to give it more of a dilute fertilizer, but a little bit of fertilizer to help it provide those elements that it needs to produce that new growth.
I don't know about anyone else, but I think that on pruning, indoors or out, I tend to err on the side of not doing enough or not cutting off enough. So when you say no more than a third, for me, it's more like, whoa, I have to make sure I'm cutting off enough because, you know, I just was thinking, and I think I tend to do more of a trim than a haircut for an analogy.
Yeah, and that's true for most people. And then they end up with plants that are very gangly looking and too big for their space. And, you know, when you first do the pruning, you may think, oh my, what have I done? This looks horrible. But then as soon as it starts to grow in, you realize, wow, that looks so much better. But when you make the initial cuts, I realize that's really hard.
It can be a little traumatic on the pruner.
Right. And there are some things you just have to prune back, you know, like, well, the citrus. If I didn't prune back my lemon trees, they would take over my entire kitchen space. Mm. I mean, I have to prune those back. Hibiscus. If hibiscus are in your life, and you are, whether you're taking them out and bringing them back in or you leave them in year-round, they must be pruned, or they will get very long and lanky and fall over, and they won't flower very nicely for you. So you just have to bite the bullet and get the pruners and just be careful about making your pruning cuts. But most of these plants are very forgiving. They're very forgiving. And if you make a wrong cut, turn the plant around so you don't have to look at it.
Well, I want to get into fertilizing and watering more, but let's go back to the phone and go to Pat in Green Bay. Hi, Pat.
Good morning. And I'm one of those people who will admit to having killed many plants, possibly the one that I'm calling about. I have some succulents that are in a hyper tufa container that I had on my patio this summer, and I brought them in this fall. And I'm wondering, they kind of look like they're already starting to not be very healthy. And I'm wondering where you would put them, in low light or keep them in light and watering for the winter to try to get them to overwinter.
A lot of the succulents will overwinter nicely inside. Some of them will overwinter outside, so I'm wondering if what you have would actually have been hardy. The problem, of course, is that they're in a container, and typically when plants are in a container outdoors in winter, it doesn't matter if they're hardy or not. They're not going to survive because the temperature of the soil in an exposed container will get so much colder than the temperature in the ground, and then you have that additional fact of freezing and thawing and freezing and thawing. And, you know, there just aren't plants that can withstand that kind of condition over our lovely Wisconsin winters. So, but for the you've already brought them inside. They may be turning yellow. They may not be looking really good. You may be losing some of their little succulent leaves. What I would say is keep them cleaned up as best as possible. Don't water them very frequently. Give them as high a light as possible, and they can stand cool temperatures, but there is a nice relationship between temperature and watering. And so if you have them in a really cool location, they may not need water for a month or two. If you've got them in a really hot location, or if they're sitting right next to a vent and they're in full sun, you know, you may need to check the soil once a week and water them once a week. But the biggest downfall for growing succulents and cacti inside is not enough light and too much water, because that's the death of them. And once they get that rot started in the base of the plant, it's pretty nasty.
Clean them up right now.
All right. Good luck with that, Pat. And actually, talking about succulents, one succulent that many of us, I think, have in our outdoor gardens is hen and chicks and those types of plants. Do those need to be mulched heavily, or what helps them get through the winter?
A little bit of winter mulch would probably not hurt them, but they're pretty hardy. They can take it as long as they're not in a container. But if they're in a container, I don't believe they'll survive.
No, mine are in the ground, so hopefully
they'll be
good.
Be fine.
I really like them. They're really satisfying to grow.
And there are a number of sedums also that, you know, we use as ground covers that look like they should die over the winter. They just look, you know, like they should be growing in somebody else's environment in the south somewhere, that actually survive very nicely and do very well in our gardens. So there are lots of plants. And we do have our native Opuntia cactus, which grows well here. Which people are, really? Wisconsin has a cactus?
I was amazed the first time I heard that.
Yeah.
And pretty skeptical. All right. Well, Nancy in Wausau has a question. So let's go to Nancy. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. Christmas cactus. I brought it inside. Is there a fertilizer I'm supposed to be using? I presume it's a succulent, so light on the water. I've got it in the basement where it's cool and it gets light.
Okay. Does it have buds on it?
No, not right now.
No flower buds? Okay, is it a crisp? Does it have little skinny leaves, or does it have heavier, fatter
leaves? It's a heavier Christmas cactus leaf.
Okay, well, it might be a Thanksgiving cactus, or it might be an Easter cactus. But if it hasn't flowered yet, I'm wondering if it might be an Easter cactus.
Okay.
Has it flowered before, Nancy?
Yes, it has. And I put it out in the summer, mm-hmm. and then bring it back in, and it's looking a little light green compared to the way it was. It was a nice, dark, rich color.
Okay. Well, light green can indicate a couple of different problems. One, it could be a nutrient problem, and it could be that it needs a little bit of fertilization. The light green color can also indicate that it's not getting enough sunlight or it's getting too much sunlight, because Christmas cacti, they do well in bright light, but sometimes when they get in direct sun, really, really heavy sun, they will turn a kind of a lighter color. So the dark green color comes when they have a little bit lower light. But the third possibility for the light green color could be that it's been overwatered. And so you have to be really careful not to overwater cacti and succulents. And the Christmas cactus is no exception to that, because it will get a rot. And it typically starts right at the base of the plant, and then the whole plant will just sort of fall over. The good news about that is that if that happens, you can take cuttings off of the exterior portion of the plant, and with a little bit of rooting hormone and some nice clean sand or some lightweight clean soil mix, you can get them to root fairly easily. Well, so from your plant, you could get lots of new plants. But if you're going to choose a fertilizer, choose one that's specifically for flowering plants if you want it to start flowering. When you go to look at flower fertilizers, you'll see that there's a million different kinds. There are just so many different brands and formulations of fertilizer. You might see one that's specifically for cacti, and that would not be a bad thing either. And the difference is just in the ratio of nitrogen and mm-hmm. phosphorus and potassium, but also in some of the minor nutrients. So for flowering plants, you might find that they have included some magnesium or sulfur or some of the other elements that are not in a basic nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium type fertilizer.
Well, good luck with that, Nancy. I hope you get some blossoms in the next month or so.
I hope so, too. But it could be that it's a later flowering cultivar or a later flowering species. There are several species of Christmas cactus, and they don't all flower at the same time.
And while we're on the kind of seasonal holiday-type plants, let's talk about a few others. What about an amaryllis?
Amaryllis are, they're fun to grow. You can sometimes get them to rebloom the next year if you're clever and know how to care for those bulbs over the remainder of the year. They should be starting to flower now if they have been treated properly for Christmas bloom. And they're a wonderful gift plant. But if you're going to give them as a gift plant, I recommend buying one that already has a flower stalk and a bud. You know, it doesn't have to be open or in full flower, but to give somebody an empty pot with a bulb in it and no plant yet, is, unless they are, you know, a really avid gardener, that's going to be a disappointment to them, because it won't flower until, you know, March.
No matter how big the bow on is.
Yeah. So, you know, we're looking at, you know, it's only a few weeks now till Christmas, and so if you're giving it as a gift plant, you know, try to find one that already has the flower stalk. And it's really, the flower stalk is different looking from the foliage. So you might have that mm-hmm. strappy green kind of soft, floppy foliage on the outside. But the flower stalk is very rigid, and you'll be able to see the bulb, the flower forming on the top of that flower stalk well before it opens. And even if you see that, it'll be a couple of weeks before that flower opens. It takes a while for that stalk to elongate and the bud to open.
And what about poinsettias?
You know, poinsettias, I don't know if you've been out to any local greenhouses recently, but it's just the world of poinsettias is so amazing. And to go into the greenhouses now, because people are just now starting to purchase them, so the greenhouses are full of them, you know, thousands of all of these different beautiful colors. And of course you can get decorator ones that are all painted. In our area, we have a greenhouse that makes a Paxetia poinsettia, And so it's green and gold.
Hmm. Oh.
For the Packers. So you
got
can
it.
Celebrate your Packer spirit even at Christmas with your poinsettias. So you can find all sorts of really interesting ones. You know, they are pretty easy to care for. And as a plant person, I hate to actually say this out loud, but it is a plant that we consider disposable.
Mm-hmm.
You, of course, can grow them year-round, and you can, with some care and careful care, I should say, you can get them to rebloom at Christmas, but their normal bloom time is in the late winter or early spring. But they make nice houseplants, and they are beautiful at Christmas, and that deep red one is, mm-hmm. you know, what I always think of for Christmas, and I like to have them in my house. Easy to care for. Take them to the sink to water them. Remove that decorative foil or tray. Put them in the sink. Water till it water comes out the bottom. Let them drain thoroughly. Put the foil back on, and then put them back wherever you want them in your house. The poinsettia, you know, when it's in, when those bracts are in color. You can put it anywhere in your house. It's not the cooler the better, because those bracts will last longer if they're cooler, and they actually will last longer if they're not in direct sun. So they can be used for decoration all over the house. If you're planning on growing it as a plant, once Christmas is done, now find a nice bright location for it. Add some fertilizer. As soon as the bracts fall, you'd want to prune it back and encourage some new side growth.
And you're saying bracts. What is bracts?
The bracts
exactly?
are the colored pieces.
Okay, because it doesn't seem like a true flower.
It's not. The flower, and this is interesting, when you're looking at, you know, if you want to find a poinsettia that's going to last a long time and be in color a long time, you know, choose the type that you like. And so now you have the rose types, and you've got the jingle bells with the speckles, and you've got the marble kinds and the Monets and all the different ones that are pink, and, you know, you can buy all different colors and patterns. So choose the one that you like, the size that you like, the shape, the color, but then look at the very center. So the bracts are the colored leaves. Look in the very center, and you'll see the flower. And the flower is very tiny, and it's actually yellow. But if it's fully open or all of the petals have dropped, then that plant has been in flower for a long time, and the bracts won't last as long. But if you can find one where you can see the little flower buds still closed, that's a newly flowering plant, and that means that the bracts have a much longer time to last in your home, so you'll have more color for a longer period of time.
And are poinsettias poisonous?
No, they're not. They're in the, you know, they're a euphorbia. So they kind of got a bad rap because they have that milky white sap.
Mm-hmm.
And some people are sensitive to that sap. And so if you get it on your skin, you may or may not get a rash from it. But the plants themselves are not poisonous. I don't recommend eating them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing I haven't eaten them personally, but I don't think they would taste very good because it's a euphorbia. They probably are fairly bitter,
mm-hmm.
so you wouldn't want to eat them. But they're not poisonous. They're not poisonous at all. And, you know, if you ate one leaf, it wouldn't hurt you at all. If you ate a bunch of them, it might make you sick to your stomach. But a lot of things are like that.
Right. It's Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller, talking with Patty Nagai, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. We'll be right back to answer your questions after this announcement. We are talking about healthy, happy houseplants with UW Extension Horticulture Educator Patty Nagai. And Patty, we have several people who would like to join the conversation, so let's go right to the phone. Julie in Lake Geneva is up first. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good, thank you. I have several large houseplants that I put out in the summer and bring in the winter. And I've noticed that I've got little teeny tiny black gnat-like bugs that kind of live in the soil. It seems that it's in the ones that haven't been repotted most recently. I don't know if you can tell me, excuse me, what they are and how to get rid of them. And I can take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Thanks, Julie.
That's a great question. So it sounds like maybe you have an infestation of fungus gnats, and your description of gnat-like creatures is pretty accurate, because fungus gnats live on organic matter in the soil, and they do get in our houseplants. They can get in houseplants even that haven't been outside. They're pretty common. A lot of times people will confuse them with fruit flies. But if you've gotten rid of all of your fruit and you have cleaned up and you still have these annoying little insects, then, you know, chances are they are fungus gnats. And they're not that difficult to get rid of once you have them. You don't have to repot. But typically their eggs and the larvae of these insects will be in the top inch or two of soil. So some people have tried actually scooping out just the top layer of soil and getting rid of that and then replacing the soil. I don't know how beneficial that is. There are some other ways that you can combat them. The first thing is to stop watering your plants, because they have to have moisture to live. And if you can let your plants dry out for a little bit, often it will kill the eggs and the larvae. So make sure that you're not overwatering your plants. And you can put your finger down in the soil. If these are really big pots, you know, you want moisture to be down at the bottom of the pot, not necessarily at the top of the pot, because the top of the pot has not as many roots that are actively taking up water and nutrients. And so when you water, make sure that you water so that it goes all the way down through the bottom of the pot and drains out the bottom, and then let the pot dry out at least several inches down and keep it dry for as long as you can without hurting your plants. And that will help control the larvae and the eggs that are going to be in that top layer of soil. The second thing that you can do is go to your local garden center and look for something called white fly traps or sticky yellow sheets. And they are yellow cards that are coated with a very, very sticky glue. And I warn you, don't get this in your hair. Don't lean over. And
that sounds like experience talking.
Oh, it's a very bad thing. Very, very bad. It is incredibly sticky stuff. And they come with hangers, or they come with little stakes, and you can put them in the soil. You know, you can put the stake in the soil and have the little yellow sticky cards sitting right above the soil, or you can have them hanging from the plant if it's, you know, if it's a taller, like a hibiscus or something that has a branch that you can hang the card from. And I find these very, very rewarding. I love sticky yellow sheets because, you know, within minutes of putting them up, those wonderful little fungus gnats will adhere themselves to them, and you can count them, and it's just so exciting.
Yeah,
you know, it's working. It's an insect control that you can visibly see the results.
Instant gratification.
Instant gratification. It's wonderful. And so you want to make sure that that you have them where you're not going to get stuck to them, or your cat's not going to get stuck to them, or your children, because they really are very, very sticky. But they work really well, and that will help control the adults. And so you grab the adults, you dry out the soil layer where the babies are, and you can control them that way.
So you're interrupting the life cycle.
Right. So if you're still having problems with them, there is a BT treatment, which is organic, Bacillus thuringiensis, that's specifically for fungus gnats, and it's called Natrol, G-N-A-T-R-O-L. And you mix it up, you drench the soil, and because it's a BT product that affects larvae, it kills the larvae. So you might not be able to find it locally. You can ask for it. You might have to order it. But it works. You have to do several treatments, and it's safe. It only affects that particular kind of insect larvae, and it is organic. But I found that just letting the soil dry out and controlling the adults with the white fly traps works pretty well for controlling those insects.
Great. Let's go to Norman in Wausau next. Hi, Norman.
Hi. I have to ask Patty, since she mentioned that she's got these citrus plants mm-hmm. that are growing so good, she has to trim them so they don't take over her place. I've been trying to grow citrus plants for about 8 years, and my success has been just terrible. I currently have two Meyer lemons that are about, plants are about 8, 10 inches high, and I got two that I got developed from some seeds. They're also about the same height. And in the meantime, I've lost four. Now, the Meyer lemons that I have now, they want to bud out with flowers, but they don't seem to want to form new growth like leaves. In fact, one of the plants just lost two of the bigger leaves. They kind of turned yellow and fell off. I'm growing them in a combination of red pine bark that's kind of rotten, sand, perlite, potting soil, and some rotten manure. And I try to leave them dry out so that either by my moisture meter or finger test, they're pretty dry down a couple inches, and then I water them pretty good, which is about once a week. What am I doing wrong?
Well, that's interesting. I don't grow Meyer lemons, actually. I have Eureka lemons, and I've been pretty happy. I've had mine for about 8 years also, and I hate to tell you this, but I have to brag. I had 52 lemons on my two lemon trees.
Oh, my goodness.
Inside my house. So
that must have smelled wonderful.
It was, well, you know, the foliage of citrus smells really good, too, so it's not just the lemons. And then I also have a lime. And my lime is really small, like you're describing your Meyer lemons. It's called a Bears lime, B-E-A-R-S-S lime, and it's a smaller, shrubbier kind of plant. But it produces limes really well, too. I've had as many as a dozen limes on it at one time. So let's address a couple of different things for you, because the Meyer lemon is an interesting plant. If it's grown from seed, I would say that the seedlings are probably not true Meyer lemons anymore, because the cross-pollination, you're not really sure where those seeds, where the daddy came from for those seeds, and so they might not truly be Meyer lemons if they come from seedlings, because I believe most of the Meyers are produced clonally through vegetative propagation, so through cuttings. But if you have some that you started with that were labeled as Meyer lemons, those should be a little bit taller than that. You said they're only 18 inches.
Not even 18. I got them at about 6 inches, which was this spring, and now they're about 8 or 9 inches.
Well, it makes me wonder if they really are Meyer lemons, because Meyer lemons should be, you know, a good 4 feet tall or so by now. So, you know, I will tell you that you can keep playing around with these little the seedlings and these smaller plants that you have, but you might be ready to invest in a new plant and go ahead and buy one that's a little bit bigger to start with, maybe one that's a couple of feet tall, that you know is that cultivar and will grow better for you. It could be that you've just got some duds, too. But, you know, it sounds like you're doing well with your soil, and I'm assuming you have them in really bright light.
The best I can. Unfortunately, we have those windows, you know, that got that low-E glass
right.
treatment. But they're in a sunroom, and I also have two fluorescent lights that I turn the cover at an angle, and they're about 8 to 10 inches from the plants. And I usually leave those on during the day, like today when it's cloudy.
You are doing what you should be doing to keep them growing nicely. So I'm really going back to wondering whether or not they truly are Meyer lemons, and whether or not you have some plants that just aren't going to get any bigger than that. And if you want them to produce lemons, and you said they're flowering, but you're not getting a lot of new leaf growth.
Right.
So even though you're working with a highly organic soil, which citrus really like, they do like to be fertilized on a regular basis, and there are some citrus fertilizers that are organic in nature that have fish emulsion in them, and those work really well with citrus, but they're a little smelly. If you want to use a synthetic fertilizer, I would use a fertilizer that is formulated for flowering plants that has a lot of the micronutrients in it, especially the magnesium and sulfur. And if you can't find something like that, you might want to supplement your fertilization with some Epsom salts. So you take about a teaspoon of Epsom salts in a gallon of water and do that about once a month or so on your plants. And that gives them a little bit of magnesium and sulfur, which can help with that flower and fruit formation. And I found that the citrus really respond very well to that. It sounds like you're doing all of the right things. I just think that you've got some interesting little micro dwarf plants that don't want to grow.
And it sounds, Norman, like if you get real Meyer lemons with all that great care that you're giving them, that you'll be in lemon heaven too.
You'll be in lemon heaven. Now, I do put mine outside in the summer. I actually put them out in late spring. As soon as we get past the really heavy freeze, I will put them outside. And so my plants stay outside from May through the middle of October. And so they get really good full sun. And that's when I do the pruning, and I make sure that they stay clean. I hose them off every day, and I give them, you know, I feed them on a regular basis. And I find that they flower really nicely. And then I have the added benefit of bees to help with the pollination. If you're not getting a lot of fruit production, you can hand pollinate. You know, lemon blossoms are really interesting because sometimes they have perfect flowers, which means they have all of their parts, and they're complete, and they have the male parts and the female parts. Sometimes they send out flowers that are only male, and they don't have the female part. So if they don't have the female part, they're not going to make any fruit.
Mm-hmm. I had that happen with zucchini.
Yeah, and so, well, zucchini is always like that. Okay. Lemon produces a lot of different kinds of flowers, so you have to look at the flowers really carefully. Mm. And when they open in the morning, you know, you can play bee and take some of the male-only flowers or take some of the flowers from a different plant, and you can go around and help to pollinate them. So you can pretend you're a bee. It helps if you make a little buzzing sound
there you
while
go.
You're doing it.
At least you won't feel so silly, or maybe you'll feel sillier and it'll be more fun.
Sure.
Well, Patty Nagai is our guest on Garden Talk today. She is UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County, sharing tips on healthy and happy houseplants. And I want to let you know, if you're shopping online this holiday season, we hope you'll check out our website at WPR.org/shop to find out if your online purchases can benefit your favorite radio station here on the Wisconsin Public Radio Network. That's WPR.org/shop. And we would certainly appreciate your support of that here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are back with more Garden Talk with Patty Nagai, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us. And Patty, we have some folks that would like to get in on the conversation, so let's go right back to the phones. Teresa in Heartland has a question. Hi, Teresa.
Yeah. Hello. I have a couple questions. I have a question about my aloe plant and how to start new plants from the real huge plant I do have. And also I wanted to ask some more questions about the citrus plants. I have lemon, orange, and grapefruit seeds that I planted, and they're really huge, probably 2 or 3 feet tall, and that, some of them. But they have never produced fruit, and I've had them growing for several years, too. And I had talked on another plant program where they said if my seeds I grew from seeds from Florida, from fruit that was from Florida, and he was saying that that if you got them from Florida, that they had to get as big as the Florida trees before they start producing fruit.
Right.
Or is there a way that I can propagate them to? Because
no,
they don't even get flowers or nothing on them.
No, okay. There are a couple of issues there. Whenever we grow fruit, you know, seeds are amazing things, and I love growing things from seed. But when we're talking about fruit and growing from seed, you don't know what that seed is going to produce because it is a product of sexual reproduction, which means there was a female, which was the fruit that you ate, you know, that was the mother plant, and so you know that it might have been that particular kind of orange or lemon. But there was also a male involved, and you don't know where that male came from, because the pollen could have come from any number of other types of citrus, and they can pollinate across, you know, different cultivars and in some cases across species. So you don't know what the male version of that citrus might have been. So there, that's the first issue, is that even though the seed came from a beautiful orange, it's very unlikely that if it ever produced fruit that you would get that kind of a fruit or any kind of edible fruit. You know, it's a problem with apples too. So you just don't know what you're getting. But the second issue is what you had been told previously, is that, you know, fruit trees in Florida are huge. You know, they can be 30 feet tall. And to reach sexual maturity where they would start flowering and producing fruit might take 10 years before they get to that size. And it may not ever happen as an interior plant indoors. The third issue with growing citrus from seed is that they often will produce thorns, because that is a natural characteristic of citrus trees that has been bred out of them with the cultivated varieties that we have. And so you can get huge, like 2 to 3 inch thorns on the stems of citrus seedlings, which can be very dangerous.
Wow, yeah.
In the house, and very pokey. So there are lots of reasons, you know, and I love growing things from seed. I find it very, you know, my kids love to do that. But if you're actively looking to grow citrus indoors and get fruit, flower and fruit production, it really is important that you purchase a cultivated variety that has been produced vegetatively or, you know, clonally, either through tissue culture or through cuttings. They're not that expensive. Most of your local garden centers will sell them. You can buy them through the internet. I mean, there are a lot of different ways that you can get these cultivated varieties of lemons, oranges, and grapefruit and limes that you know what you're working with and you know that you're going to get fruit. You know, if you really want to be sure, buy a plant that's already got flowers and fruit on it, because once citrus starts flowering, they flower sort of intermittently throughout the year. So, for example, my citrus have fruit on them right now that is ripening, and they're also flowering at the same time. So they'll have another batch of fruit. So it's kind of like a continuous process. It's very different from a lot of the fruit trees that we grow here in Wisconsin.
And then Teresa also had a question about how to start new aloe plants from her large aloe.
Oh, right. So aloe is a really interesting succulent that grows from the base of the plant. And if you take cuttings off of aloe, I believe you have to let them dry out first. And if you use rooting hormone and put them in a sand-based or a really well-drained, clean soil mixture, you can get them to root. But the best way is to, it's kind of like by division down at the base of the plant, and you would want to separate them down at the base of the plant. A lot of times you can see little offshoots coming from the base of the plant. So aloe is a little bit more difficult to propagate than some of the other types of succulents and cacti, because it's hard to see a joint and an actual place where roots can form, but it can be done through cuttings.
All right. Thanks for that call, Teresa. And there was a little discussion on the Facebook page. That's The Larry Mehler Show on Facebook. And Mehler is M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And Katrine was asking about easy-to-keep plants that are also safe for nibbling critters. And I think people also think of, you know, small children that might just get some a leaf in their mouth and things like that. What are some families of plants that are considered safe? And also, what are some that people should really avoid if they have any animals or children that could possibly be coming in contact with that?
Right. Well, you know, there are some plants that are really poisonous to cats and dogs that aren't as big of a problem for people. You know, they would make us sick, but a lot of these plants can cause kidney failure in cats, especially like the lilies. So anything in the lily family is really deadly for cats, and you should avoid them in your house if you have cats. So that includes amaryllis, unfortunately. So, you know, if you have plants that are given to you as gifts and you know that you have a cat that will eat plants, either put it somewhere where the cat can absolutely not get to it, or re-gift it, because it's very risky to have those kind of plants in your house. The other one is that the arum family that I mentioned earlier, easy to care for plants, pothos, philodendron, all of those in that family, anthuriums. But they have some nice crystals in the leaves that can cause some problems with animals or with children if they chew on them. You know, the nice thing about kids trying to chew on plants is that they usually don't do it more than once because they find that things taste bad. The things that you'd want to be really careful about, though, are things that are truly poisonous, like one time will be enough to kill children or pets. And that includes, the Jerusalem cherry is in the Solanaceae family. It's in the tomato family. But the fruit on that plant is very, very poisonous. Castor beans, not usually grown as houseplants, but the castor bean seed is incredibly deadly. And there are a number of other ones that I'm but they're slipping my mind at the moment.
Is that the kind of thing that there would be information at the UW Extension website?
We currently don't have a list of poisonous plants, but it's something we've been talking about. You know, the best place to find poisonous plant listings is actually at Children's Hospital.
Oh, that's a great idea.
So if you go to any of the Children's Hospital websites, you can get a really nice printable one-page sheet of poisonous house plants and poisonous exterior plants.
Oh, that's good to know.
Because it's a very common problem with children. And it's not just interior plants. A lot of our very common exterior shrubs and trees can be poisonous as well. And children, of course, are very interested in all things shiny and red and
right.
We have a number of those things in our yards that they really shouldn't be eating. You know, I always recommend to parents and to teachers to encourage children not to put plants in their mouth of any kind. Never put mushrooms in their mouth, no leaves, no nothing, unless they have an adult who is there that knows for certain that that is an edible plant. Because there are so many things out there that are very, very poisonous.
And I'm guessing for pets, a veterinarian would be a good resource for knowing what is particularly dangerous for cats or dogs or other animals.
Most vets will have lists of those plants as well that are particularly poisonous for animals. And, you know, a lot of the house plants, it's really interesting. You know, cats especially, dogs sometimes will eat plants as well. But it's normally the cats that we get the questions about. And a lot of times they will chew on plants and it will just make them throw up. And that's actually why they do it. It's a purging type of thing that animals do. But there are some things they really, even if they ate them and threw them back up, it might make them very ill. Mm-hmm. So you should avoid having those in your house.
Thanks for that question, Teresa. And if you have a question for UW Extension horticulture educator Patty Nagai, you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Chris Molina, our on-air producer, he will get those calls and emails to us. And Patty, we have Jack in Chicago next. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Patty. Thanks so much for a great show today. I really enjoying it driving back to Chicago.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. I've recently brought some beautiful tea plants in that were out in some landscaping in Chicago into the home, repotted them, mature plants, and really wanted to get your feedback on whether or not we should stop watering them, the amount of light that we're going to need, and then whether they should be cut back in the spring to get promote growth next spring.
Okay, are we talking TTI or TTEA?
I'm sorry, I apologize. They'd be closer to the Hawaiian tea plant.
That's the TI plant. Well, I have to always ask that because some people pronounce it Thai, and it's not Thai, but then at least I know which plant they're talking about because tea plants. TEA plants that we get our tea from are actually a camellia, and those can be grown as houseplants here also, but they're kind of tricky to grow. But those are fun to grow as well. But you're talking about a very tropical Hawaiian tea plant that can be really colorful. Those are really great plants. I have never grown them as a houseplant before. But I would imagine that they're very similar to a lot of the plants that are New Zealand the New Zealand grass plants or the dracaenas. I would think that they would be very similar in care there. So even though you're thinking about tropics, they don't necessarily want to be kept wet. A humid environment, though, would be really helpful. I would say try to keep them growing as houseplants throughout the year, so you want bright light. You want a lot of humidity, so they will be happier if they are placed around other plants because when you group your plants together and if you had the ability to measure the humidity, you would find that your apartment or your house humidity in the rest of the world might be 20 to 30%, it might be really low, but right around those plants, you know, within a few inches of those leaves, you might have 60 to 70% relative humidity, which is what those plants really enjoy. The death to tropical plants like that is going to be dry air. So keep them away from vents. You don't want hot air blowing on them. You don't want them next to the fireplace. You want them surrounded with other plants so that they can have a really nice little humid microclimate, and be very careful not to overwater them. So let them dry out a little bit between waters. Make sure that you're not, you know, wilting them and letting them go completely dry, but make sure that they don't stay soppy wet, and you never want them sitting in water, you know, where the root systems are totally, totally without oxygen.
Thanks for that call, Jack. And there is a photo that Chris put up on Facebook for us. Kathleen emailed a photo in and said, I have an out-of-control rosemary plant. It started out as a 3-inch tall plant in a mixed pot that I received as a gift about 4 years ago. I put it outside each summer and move it in the winter. It's about 3 or 4 feet tall and bushy. It would make a nice large bonsai. It is crowding out everything else in my limited window space indoors. How can I prune this to get it back to a manageable size? I'd hate to kill it after all this generosity on the part of the plant.
I see the photo, and it does look quite large.
It does.
So the nice thing about pruning back rosemary is that it's edible.
Right.
And so it's kind of gangly looking, so I would say it definitely does need to be pruned back. And I would say that you can prune this back. I would say prune off those side branches at least 8 or 10 inches, and do it sort of uniformly around the entire plant so that it looks like it's a little bit one-sided. So mm-hmm. Maybe you want to prune more on one side than the other to try and even it up a little bit. And then as you're progressing through the winter, make sure you're turning that pot on a regular basis so that each side gets that full sun effect from the window throughout the season. But the cool thing about rosemary is that you can prune those limbs back, and you can, of course, use them fresh, or you can hang them and let them dry mm-hmm. and use them as dry rosemary throughout the winter. But if they have some stiffness to them, and it looks like that plant is big enough that the branches may have some stiffness, you can use them as skewers.
Oh.
So, and you can use them either for vegetables, if you're into just eating veggies, or you can use them for chicken or beef or pork, and use them as skewers and skewer the meat or the vegetables onto the skewers and get the most wonderful rosemary-infused flavor into your food.
And rosemary is such a wonderful scent and flavor.
Wonderful. The other thing you can use them for is potpourri. So you can take the leaves off and let them dry and encase them in a piece of cloth, a little sack of some sort, and put them in your car.
Great,
I
yeah.
have rosemary in my car, and it smells wonderful.
It's really a lovely scent.
It's a wonderful scent. But at this point, I would say don't worry. That's a pretty good-sized plant. I would say don't worry too much about pruning it back. But the thing that is very tricky about having rosemary in the house is that they don't like to be dry. So if you let the soil dry out too much, you can lose it pretty quickly. They also don't like to be soppy wet, so you have to figure out where that magic point of moisture is in the soil and try to maintain it over the winter. They also like higher humidity, just like I was talking about with the tea plant. You can group them if you can put some other plant, and it looks like maybe she does have some other plants around mm-hmm. it. But if you group other plants around it to try and increase that local humidity a little bit, that would be very helpful to keep it going. Rosemary is not particular about fertilizer, so it probably won't need any additional fertilization over the winter. But maintaining that moisture in the soil and that humidity around the foliage is really critical. So beautiful, though. Enjoy.
Yeah.
Makes me hungry.
Yeah, it looks really lovely. Let's go to Suzanne in Mequon next. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about watering my tropicals. Mm-hmm. I have a large 75-gallon fish tank that I clean each week. And I always have, you know, gallons of this water with all the nutrients. Is that a good idea to use that to fertilize the tropicals?
Well, I've never been asked that before. I've been asked about a lot of different types of water, you know, water from dehumidifiers and water from water softeners and rainwater and all sorts of things. I'm thinking that unless you're putting something in there that is, I would think it would be toxic to the fish if it were going to be toxic to the plants. You probably have quite a bit of nitrogen in there. You might have some algae. Okay, so issues. The only two issues I am thinking of at the moment are if you've got algae problems in your fish tank, you could get algae in your soil, and you could get a nice little green layer growing around your pot. May or may not be a problem for you. And then the second one, of course, is smell, because it is fish excrement. It's going to have kind of a fishy smell to it. So after a while, your containers may start to smell somewhat fishy. Those are the only two downsides I see to it. I don't think there are any other issues. I wouldn't think that there would be any disease issues, diseases of fish, diseases of insect, of plants, not necessarily in the same world, so that shouldn't be a problem.
All right. Well,
but it might be a smell issue. That would be.
And maybe Suzanne wants to start with, you know, one or two plants and sees how it goes.
Try it and see how it goes. It's a nice way to recycle water.
Right.
But at the very, you know, I would certainly not hesitate to use it on exterior plants.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that would be perfectly fine instead of just, you know, throwing it down the sink.
Great. And let's go quickly to Bob in Eau Claire next. Hi, Bob.
Oh, yeah, I have a very large peace lily that we care for in the lobby of our church. And it's growing gangbusters, produces blooms, but the tips of all the leaves are brown. And they've been that way for, you know, a few years now. And so I just want to know if you have a cure for that.
Well, it might be the water you're using. There are a couple of reasons that the tips on the leaves turn brown. One is that the water contains too much fluoride and chlorine, and so if that's the issue, you know, the cure to that is to let your water sit in an open container for about 24 hours before you water with it, or use purified water. But if you start using purified water, you'll have to up your fertilization a little bit. Are you fertilizing this peace lily on a regular basis?
No, we haven't fertilized it.
Okay, so that's not the issue. Sometimes you get brown tips when plants are over-fertilized because one of the things that they do is they, you know, fertilizer are salts. Fertilizer formulations are salts. And so a plant, of course, needs these, but if they are in too large of abundance in the plant, many times they will take the excess salt and try to excrete it through the tips of the leaves. And when that happens, there's a process called guttation where you'll actually see droplets of fluid on the tips of the leaves, and those droplets will contain a really high concentration of salt from the fertilizer, and that can burn the tips. But if you haven't been fertilizing, then that's not the problem. So I would recommend first trying to let the water sit in an open container for a day before you water. And then the second thing that you, if you haven't been doing this and you've had that plant there for 3 years, you probably need to start looking at some fertilizer for flowering plants and something that contains, again, you know, the minor elements in addition to the major elements, because by now the nutrients in that soil are probably starting to become a little depleted. But look for a flowering plant fertilizer, and that will help keep those flowers being produced.
Great. Thanks for that call, Bob. And Patty, just in about 30 seconds, if people want to find a nice indoor plant to get kids interested in growing things, what would be one or two good choices?
Well, there are several that are really fun for kids to grow. Of course, pothos and philodendron are fun to grow because they're vines and they grow really fast and they're very difficult to kill. Those can be quite fun. The peace lily can also be fun because it has a flower on it and it can grow really well in low light. So that would be a neat one. You know, I do like orchids, and orchids are not that difficult to grow, and they're so fascinating to watch. over the course of their lifetime as they produce the buds and flower, and then they go back to their form.
Great. And unfortunately, we have to leave it there. Patty Nagai, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.